Pennies from Heaven. Welcome to Pennies from Heaven. Hopefully we'll see some dropping. Andrew Gale is the author and presenter of today's session, and Andrew's the chief actuary of Medibank Private, and as we all know, Australia's largest health insurer, and has had that role for the last 8 years. He's responsible for all the statutory appointed actuary duties, and is an active participant in the health insurance industry in relation to Institute of Actuaries practice committees as well as industry committees. So we welcome Andrew to the podium.
Well, Pennies from Heaven. Hopefully the catchy title, hopefully that's why you're here. But health insurance demutualisations, many of you in this room would well know about the four major transactions that we've had in the health insurance industry in the last 18 months or 2 years, and that has been quite a significant change in the health insurance business in Australia. And many of you in this room, I'm hoping you'll be able to have an opportunity to contribute perhaps some of your own experiences, because I know many of you have been involved in this process as well, so that would be great if you could do that. So this is just the headings from my paper, really. Just quickly cover each of these topics, catching the demutualisation wave that's broken over the private health insurance industry in the last couple of years, why funds consider demutualising, and then the ownership and regulatory considerations of a demutualisation, the principles that have been applied in the demutualisations, and in particular in the allocations to members, and comparing some of the four transactions, the allocations to members, some specific detailed issues around some of those allocations that you may not actually consider. It all sounds very simple when you give an amount per number of years, but there are some practical considerations that have need to be thought through. The actuarial advice that's been given in each of these transactions, have a look at that, and other corporate activity that's going on. So the demutualisation wave in Australia, building societies had their wave of demutualisations in the 90s, and then also in the 90s the life insurers, the major ones you'd know about, AXA or National Mutual at the time, AMP, Colonial Mutual. And 2000s, we've now had the late 2000s, these four health insurance transactions. NIB first, now a listed, the only listed private health insurer, MBF being sold to Bupa, Manchester Unity to HCF, and AHM to Medibank Private. The paper talks a bit about for-profit status, because for-profit status is the pathway to demutualisation. Health funds have to convert to being for-profit before they can be acquired or demutualised. And the for-profit health fund was a fairly rare beast in Australia, and really was only permitted from 1985, and only a few funds converted to for-profit or were established as for-profit over the years, but this has accelerated, of course, with this demutualisation trend. There's a bit of a history there, and in the paper, of the rise of the for-profit health fund. Because they no longer exist. Okay. Yeah, these are active, currently active for-profit health funds. There have been a few that have come and gone over the years. FAI, just a little history picture, I suppose, was FAI Health was the first for-profit health fund. Here's the stock exchange announcement at the time, 10 years later, when actually signed by Rodney Adler. Sold to Grand United 10 years later, and the quote was, FAI Health was one of the most profitable health insurers, but it was impossible to post an acceptable return to shareholders. Well, we've probably moved on a bit since then, because there's a whole lot of activity that's based on funds actually making acceptable returns for shareholders and being able to service dividends. Yeah. But it was really, I put that up because it was really one of the very early transactions, if you like. It was actually sold for book value, so it didn't make any profit on it, but these events have been few and far between until the last 18 months. some recent transactions. I know in Ian's paper yesterday had similar listing of the recent transactions. I've really just tried to do some really rough yardsticks, I suppose, in terms of the amount of goodwill that was paid. So this is the purchase price less the net assets of the company. I haven't tried to do any special calculations about target capital or the like, but just trying to work out how much that goodwill represents per contributor, or as an alternative, as a percentage of contributions. And while there's a whole lot of numbers there, I think the next, I've put this in graphical form. On one axis, the goodwill per contributor, and on the other axis, the goodwill as a percentage of annual contributions. You can see the transactions sort of sit in that 40 to 60% of contributions range, or $800 to $1,500 per contributor. So these are the purchase prices that have been paid. That's just one valuation yardstick. The paper yesterday went through far more precision about how you might compare the values that have been paid in recent transactions. The two Druids funds were transferred at net assets exactly, so they weren't perhaps a different sort of transaction where it was just a transfer of the business for no extra goodwill. Why demutualise? I think a significant reason has been the recent strong profits and growth in net assets in the industry. This chart shows that for about 20 years or so, the industry's net assets represented 25 to 35% of contribution income, but in the last few years that's increased up towards 50%. So there's a lot more at stake now. There's a lot more value that can be unlocked at a net asset level, setting aside the goodwill. So I think this is just highlighting the increase in underwriting profits, and I think you've probably all seen that graph that shows the last few years underwriting margins are at probably a long-term high point. Whether they can stay at that level or not to justify all these transactions is another question. So if you're going to go into a demutualisation, you need to work out who's going to be the beneficiary. There are certain ownership considerations you need to have a look at. The first thing you might have a look at is wind-up provisions, but most health insurers actually have a wind-up provision that says no money is to be paid to contributors or members. It's all to go to a charity or a like-minded institution, or in some strange circumstances, perhaps it gets paid in the risk equalisation fund. That's actually in the Private Health Insurance Act. If there's any money left over and it's not dealt with by the constitution of the company, it's got to go into the risk equalisation fund. So it'd be nice to see several hundred million come into the risk equalisation fund and distribute it to all the rest of the participants. Well, I'm sure that's not going to happen. And then you need to distinguish between membership rights and policyholder rights. Members or contributors probably principally there for their health insurance needs, so their policyholder rights, but depending on the circumstance of the organisation and its constitution, that may also have membership rights. I suppose that's what we think of as a mutual. Those organisations where the policyholders also have a right to vote, principally to change the constitution, and that is what crystallises the potential for those members to obtain some value from a demutualisation. They have the power to vote to change the constitution, to amend it in such a way that a payment can be made to those members on demutualisation. It's important to distinguish also the friendly societies. A number of friendly societies operate health funds, and there's a slightly different situation there in that, and you can see that in the transactions that have happened for the two Druids funds in recent times. The members in that instance have a membership of the friendly society as ownership rights, and not as not the health fund itself. So the membership of the friendly society is what's important there. And in both those transactions, I've mentioned in the paper that Druids members were given, or ex-Druids members were given, the opportunity to retain a membership interest in the friendly society on an ongoing basis, so that down the track, if the friendly society demutualises, they can share in the distribution of that. So they weren't able to get value on the sale of the health fund or transfer of the health fund, but they still retain an interest if they wish to continue with that interest in the friendly society. The regulatory requirements, probably parts of the Private Health Insurance Act that some of you may not have read and others I'm sure have read extremely closely. You tend to have a read of these things in great detail when you go through this process. As I said before, it involves a conversion to for-profit status, and FIAC approval is automatic if it's not a demutualisation. I think that would be an interesting one for people to exercise their minds what that would apply to. But if it is a demutualisation, FIAC can only approve it if it's two tests. Only policyholders or insured persons receive a benefit. So the benefits of a demutualisation are not to go to anyone other than policyholders or insured persons. And that it is distributed equitably. Ian.
Discussion point. There is the view that the Act, the phrase in the Act implies I must have approved it unless they are convinced he is not meeting those two hurdles, which is a slightly different kind of way of expressing it. And if you go back to the earlier slide, the point you made about the differentiation between membership rights and policyholder rights becomes quite interesting here for health funds whose constitutions have members who are a very, very much smaller subset of policyholders, whereas the Act assumes that they are all kind of members, and that's
quite
interesting.
Yeah. I mean, there's the assumption of certain things that may not apply in certain circumstances. I do accept that in some circumstances there's a council of members and...
as a member, you have to elect to be a voting member.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. So there's plenty of scope for argument and discussion around some of these points. And there are other parts. And some of these, FIAC have actually issued some guidelines that encapsulate some of these things as well. But yes, there are some unique situations in some of the funds where, it would be very interesting if NIB had attempted to distribute all of the proceeds to those 50 company members. I mean, you know, that's something that obviously was never contemplated, but you need to think through the legal position. So I think the FIAC guidelines actually prohibit those members getting any additional proceeds. Demutualisation principles, I put these up. These are, you can go and have a look at all the information memorandums. I've got them in the appendix, links to them. And there's some really good stuff there that, you know, of course, if this is something you're interested in, that you can read all this information. But I've tried to amalgamate some of the information from those information memorandums in my paper, and I thought this was, you know, a reasonable list of the sorts of things you should take into account if you're just trying to decide how to distribute the money. And each fund will have a different focus on some of these, but I think I mentioned before that the distribute the money only to policyholders, that's a FIAC given, really. But to try and avoid double dipping, so over the years there are been various consolidations and mergers and things happen. If a member has got to your fund today through a means where they had received a demutualisation payment somewhere else or something like that, it just makes sense that they are not rewarded twice for that, unless there is some contractual reason why that has to happen. And then to minimise opportunistic joins is very important as well. So if there's been talk about a transaction and you know, it's almost public knowledge, or you may get a surge in members coming in, and it would seem sensible to set cut-off dates so that at least you minimise the chance of a lot of people turning up just to get a free ride, to get a few $100 or $1,000, whatever the minimum is. So that's an important consideration. It's also important to consider that the allocation is really a windfall gain. I suppose that's the reason for my title of my paper, Pennies from Heaven. A lot of people in this process have got very strong and heated views about how much money they should get and the rights and wrongs of allocation bases and the equity of their particular situation versus others. It really is the end of the day and windfall gain. There's no right or wrong answer here, and I think that's important to keep in context when you're thinking about how to divide things up. But broadly should try and...
probably say there are demonstrably wrong answers, but there's a range of right answers.
That's, yeah.
So there are quite clearly some allocation bases which really struggle to pass on stuff.
Mm. And it's important to note that FIAC have that role to determine whether the basis is equitable. Also, the federal court have a role as well. So I think none of the bases that have been come up with have, at least the ones that have been published, there's been no public dispute about their equity. What happened to lead up to those positions, I'm not sure in all cases, but at least they were all the ones that we've had have been judged to be equitable in the circumstances. They do, and I think what you'll find here is that the last point on this slide, I won't go through the rest of them, but be consistent with past demutualisation precedent. So we've had four, there's a lot of precedent being set now for any ones that come down the track. And you probably see in some of the paper and the discussion how the bases have actually progressed in some areas to address some of the concerns that were raised, also bearing in mind that the circumstances of each demutualisation are unique. So I've got these graphs in the paper that try and compare the allocations. I suppose it's just for interest value, just to see where the differences lie. And this is for a family with combined hospital and ancillary cover without making any change to that over time. So you can generally see that I suppose they're broadly similar, although the caps apply at different periods of time. Many of these caps are talked about are the result of data limitations and fund data not being accurate before a certain date, so typically somewhere between 25 to 30 years seems to be about the limitation on going back, trawling back through the funds data when it certainly wasn't collected on the basis that it needed to be accurate for a demutualisation 30 years down the track. And certainly when they turn up in front of you with all of the paperwork to support the fact that they joined in 1953 or something. So, yes, I've seen some very old documents through this process myself, and I'm not surprised what people keep in their filing cabinets at home. So that's combined cover, and I think perhaps the relevant point I do make it in the paper is that the NIB basis has given relatively lower value to people with combined hospital and ancillary cover, but relatively higher value to those that had either just hospital only or ancillary only, because they, the virtue of the fact that the basis did not recognise the dual product holding, whereas the other three bases did. And the MBF one is interesting to note. It's the one that has made, I suppose, a different weighting decision between hospital and ancillary units. Higher weighting for hospital versus ancillary. But I suppose you can see that the maximum amount that any particular member's got out of one of these demutualisations is around about the $9,000 mark for a family that had combined hospital and ancillary cover for the 30-year duration, something like that. So we're talking about numbers around that level. I suppose the average, I haven't really done the calculation myself, but probably is around $2,000 or $3,000. So some of the allocation issues, which I've gone through in more detail in the paper, about the importance of dates, cut-off dates for whether you're in or out of the allocation, another cut-off date for whether you actually get the payment or not. So some people might have been there at the cut-off date but didn't keep their policy in force until the scheme had been approved, so they would lose their entitlement. In some cases, not in all cases, so different schemes were different. the beneficiaries, and I said before, it's really just the contributors, so the person who's the owner of the policy that's getting money, although it's not precluded that insured persons could also get a payment, although I think you need to think through that one very carefully. Data quality, I mentioned that we're really forced to consider cutting it off at some point, not just because of data limitations, but over time the organisation's history can be lost. I mean, some things that are discovered through this process about past mergers that are really of no relevance today mean that you can't really be sure how long the longest member you've had has been there. It might be the 1970s when you thought the fund started, or it might be the 1950s when some small fund that you acquired over time, they were the product of another merger. So looking into the history of the organisation is important, and really setting a sensible cut-off is probably unavoidable, I think. Membership change is a particular area of concern, a lot of cause for complaints from members. Are you or are you not going to take into account changes in product over time? So product, I mean at one level, hospital and ancillary, but at another level you could go another step lower if you thought that was warranted. I mean, people paying you high premiums on top cover must have made a better, well, maybe they have, maybe they haven't, a better contribution to value than somebody on your cheapest product. Certainly ambulance only has been carved out as having a differential weighting in most of the allocations, but that's been the extent of product differentiation that's taken into account. Changes in family type over time, change from singles to families and back to singles. You think of all the life events that happen to people. Widows in particular, I think, have had a long history of family and husband dies and then they're single. What happens to those people if you just base it on their single status at the cut-off date? And suspensions and lapse, another controversial one, I suppose. Health funds have traditionally allowed members to suspend their policy. Perhaps they're going overseas for 6 months or 12 months. Some circumstances, I think financial hardship and farmers and goodness knows what the practices of a fund are. But whether it's been done validly or people just lapsed their policy and then came back and wanted to rejoin will make a big difference to the allocation. So if somebody drops their policy for 1 month, maybe that just something happened with bank deductions or payroll deductions in the past, you know, what the fund accepts as reasonable or not at the time for waiting periods is one thing, and how they treat those sort of short-term lapses, I suppose I'd describe them, or accidental lapses, how they treat them in the allocation is very important when you're looking at cutting somebody out from 30 years worth of credit and only giving them 5 or 10. And it might be an event that happened 15 years ago that they've long since forgotten about. Yeah, and I do mention in the paper that it's traditionally been that it's more likely that the male is the policy owner and the female is the spouse, and so it's interesting to think through whether there's any indirect discrimination going on there. You're talking about 50 years, 30 years, 50 years of past health insurance administration practice, and these are not problems that you're going to be able to solve in the demutualisation. I suppose what's important is to try and do something that's equitable. Yeah. And member expectations, I put that there. I think perhaps in some areas, at least this has been the health insurance barbecue stopper, if you like. People talk to each other. You know, oh, you're a member of MBF, so am I. I'm getting this, I'm getting that. AHM, I'm getting this, I'm getting that. Oh, but hang on, aren't you in the same circumstance as me? And letters come in, you know, this is not fair. My aunt, uncle, brother, sister, neighbour, whatever, is getting more than me. They obviously don't understand how the allocation rules are applied in their circumstance, but it's certainly an expectation. When there's money being thrown around, there's plenty of expectations that particular members should get a better treatment. And I talked about prior mergers and acquisitions. It's very important to try and work through the history of how people have come to where they are today. Lots of members think they've been with your fund for the whole time, but then it's apparent that they're actually off with HCF for a period, or they're off at HBF, and it's all health insurance to them. So, and different brands over different times, health funds gone by different names. And base allocation versus tenure allocation is more about, I suppose, allocating the contribution that's arisen from current members versus members who are no longer there, and trying to, and also recognising that, you know, it's one member, one vote. Now, I've got an allocation example for a fictional family here. It is a fictional family. And this just gives you a flavour, I suppose just a little picture of what is possible. The red is, you know, Homer's the contributor there, but so Homer and Madge, they were single once before they got married, and they had, Madge actually took out her policy a couple of years before Homer, but he came in and then was only in for 2 years and then dropped out, and he's come back in again, and they got married at that point. So, and at that point, Homer became the contributor. So Madge discontinued her policy and joined Homer. So she became an insured person in green rather than red. And then they had a couple of kids. And then from year 16 to 18, they actually switched contributors, probably because you know, Madge could have her contributions taken out of her payroll. And it was just a convenient way of doing it, rather than having to front up and pay the cash all those years ago or whatever it was. And then that job finished, and then they just went back to the way they'd previously done it. So you can have lots and lots of changes over time. People couple together, contributors switch. I haven't got any deaths here yet, but I've got a separation. I don't think this really happened on The Simpsons, but anyway. They separated about 5 years before their fund demutualised. And so at that point, Madge took off. The kids had grown up. They had their own health insurance policies, although Bart dropped out a few years later. But so the four of them are there at the allocation. So what happens to them? Well, I've got some calculations there. Homer, we look backwards from that endpoint. Homer's had 5 years of single from the day they separated, and he had 1 year of single just before they got married. And then through the rest of the time, 29 years of family. Now, two of those years, Madge was the contributor, but that was really just an administrative issue around continuation of that policy. So that switching of contributor didn't involve any other change to the policy. So in my example here, Homer's going to get credit for 29 years of family membership and 6 years of single. And Madge is only going to get 5 years of single because that's all she's had. The rest of the time, she's been an insured person. Now, prior to getting married, she had 6 years of single membership, but that was all lost when she cancelled that policy. That policy is no longer in force. And while she's been continuously an insured person, that doesn't give her a rise to any benefits. She's only been the owner of a policy for the last 5 years. And the children's more simple because it's only the time that they've had their own policies, not the time they've been insured. Certainly I've seen a lot of letters from younger people in their early 20s that say, well, I've been insured since birth, so why are you only giving me 5 years' worth of credit? I want 25, you know. So let's just give you a bit of a flavour of what's possible. And the deaths are also a very important issue as well. So if the contributor dies and the spouse takes over the ownership of the policy, then credit will be given for the past history. Well, I think this is a suggestion. Credit can be given to the survivor. But if they separate and one and he dies just shortly afterwards, then it's an unrelated event. It's not related to the change in the contributor being a result of death, but a result of separation.
So if your spouse dies right in the middle of all of this, it's better to stick her in the cupboard until the money comes home and take her out of the cupboard.
And there's some interesting situations like that that you may be better off not advising an event until after the money's been paid out, if they do happen very close to the payment date. Well, I do cover just a few things about, you know, looking at all of that. You've got to say there are some contentious issues. Short-term lapses, I think, is a particularly important one. Somebody's lapsed for 1, 2, 3, 4 months. It might be you're digging back into something that happened 20 years ago.
I think you also have to look at the fund
Yeah. So past practice is important. And actually, of course, when you're faced with a demutualisation, you probably have to tighten up past practice to be more in line with the rules. But that's a cause of angst as well. And that's exactly the letters that come in their thousands. But it comes to an end to a legal issue of who owns the policy. Madge didn't own the policy.
There's an issue of entitlement and initial application. So I wasn't sure if the question was about someone needing recognition for
the right. And so sorry, I need to go back here. Somehow I got back to it. What's happening here, you can see home is getting recognition for 29 years of family. And if you took the view that the policy is jointly owned by the contributor and the spouse, if you took that view, then they really should be retrospectively making some carve-up of that 29 years of family membership that home is getting paid. The money is being paid for this collection of policies in accordance with the rules. It's just, is it fair... Because that policy was terminated. Yeah. And now think about the situation. Think about the other situation where rather than Madge coming onto Homer's policy, Homer went onto Madge's policy, and they would have that because it would be continuous cover. So there are all these very important issues about things that happened many years ago. And the difficulty with the allocation review committees is they're only charged with applying the rules, not with actually changing the rules to make them more fair. So I think these are important issues.
The CEO's model explain that to them. Sorry, just to add an observation as well, and I appreciate you have a health focus. If you go back to the earlier life demutualisations, then you had these sorts of issues in spades because the commonly not more than all vote. So the kind of number of votes that you got was a function of the size of your policy and hence the number of policies you held. So as an individual at the cut-off date of the demutualisation, policies you held, at least for some of them, define your entitlement to share in the spoils. You might have had six other policies along the way, as you lapsed progressively but collectively you made a bunch, you might feel you've made a much greater contribution.
No, but Madge knows it and she'll tell you about it. Sorry, Peter?
The truth of the matter is it's sort of tontine going on here and there's a whole lot of people who dropped out in the 12 months before and two, whatever, and there's a whole lot of Madges out there. Madge just happened to marry a bloke who kept the policy going. And I mean, I can remember a conversation with you, Andrew, where I said the cut-off date should not go back more than 10 years, because going back beyond there, almost everything that happened back there, the degree of inequity is so unfair. I mean, one of the factors that isn't taken into account is your age. And, you know, these young people that are paying premiums have actually... No, you give 70-year-olds the same amount as you give any people who've entered at the age of 60 the same as you give people who enter the age of 20. Because they're there for 10 years.
Yeah.
And, well, what's wrong with it is we've got community rating, and people who are young are far more profitable members. And the people who enter when they're 60 get huge benefits as they go along.
Well,
so,
well
no,
that
no.
Did you give some of the money to all the others?
Well, exactly. This is exactly the point. So really, if you took, if you just gave everyone an equal amount who had been in there for, say, at least 2 years or something, and some sort of notional amount to the shorter-term people. I mean, another factor that's not taken into account was relevant to the fund that you bought, I think, Andrew, was that, I mean, they nearly went belly up 10 years before. So everybody that... Everybody that was in that fund up to that 10 years, I mean, the fund virtually had no assets. And all of the members in that last 10 years have essentially put that fund back on its feet.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, these are factors that are simply not... So what you're really doing is it's a kind of democracy that's going on here, and a tontine.
Yeah.
You're saying, well, you know...
Well, I think another factor, we haven't really talked about it, but, you know, you've got to get a vote over the line as well. So the large majority of members, at least those that are compelled, interested enough to vote in it, need to be convinced that this is a reasonable outcome. So you wouldn't want to put in place an allocation basis that meant disenfranchised too many people and meant that it would be difficult to actually achieve the outcome.
Guys, I think really there's a lot of debate coming from the floor. We're not using the mic. I don't know if you're concerned about... we don't seem to be getting a bell because I guess it's lunchtime, so we can probably carry on this debate all the way through lunch, but probably a good idea if we're actually going to get lengthy contributions from the floor. If you can just get up to the mic and just say your name first.
Perhaps, Peter...
It's been a great discussion, and I really haven't wanted to butt into it, but it's really fascinating, and but it is an issue that just won't resolve. David, do you want to come up and maybe... Yeah. And Andrew, I don't know if you want to finish your presentation.
I would like to. Perhaps we'll take one or two more and then I'll try and get through the last four
slides. I'll just
do
this properly. David Terrence, I must admit, I find this whole concept of demutualisations and paying money out and everything just absolutely fascinating. And I think one of the issues that hasn't actually, why do we do it? And I think a lot of this has been testosterone fueled rather than any other logic to it. But one of the things that does concern me is that, you know, we're talking about looking at, you know, precedents and saying what's happened, and yet we're sitting in a situation economically where we've said that people have paid way too much for assets in the past. My major concern is I think a lot of these demutualisations have actually probably paid too much and given that money away. So I just really do wonder, you know, if there are going to be future demutualisations, how much of that precedent we really need to take into account, or whether we do accept that, you know, we've actually paid way too much for some of these assets. Just a controversial comment.
Ian Burningham, just a counter comment is, I guess the perspective I have, David, on that question is that Andrew's paper is, I guess, to a degree independent of the quantum of money that's being distributed, and is talking about how do you distribute that quantum of money. So I accept a lot of your points about whether the assets are overpriced based on the current economic conditions, but I personally doubt that if it was $1 billion or $2 billion, would the allocation of that money be very different? I mean, you might argue about kind of minimums, and you might argue about... well, the dollars are very different. Yeah, I accept that, but if you're talking about purely the allocation formula, I don't think that you can actually change the quantum. I mean, there's a defined bucket of money, and all this is doing is figuring out how do you distribute the bucket. And the actual quantum, I think, is a slightly different issue. Anyway.
Andrew, back to you.
Yeah, I'll try and get through this. So, I suppose just some observations of my own about the bases that come up. I was talking about the short-term lapse issue. I think it's important, and perhaps there's no other way around that but to really just rigorously apply the rules of the fund, and perhaps err on the side of generosity if there's any grayness about the circumstance of what actually happened for someone to miss a contribution if it was only a one-month lapse. Product change, I think that is important to make some recognition of changes in product, at least at the hospital ancillary level over time. The difference between someone who's got hospital only and hospital ancillary today is important. Family formation and separation, I talked through some of those issues with my little example, that it gives rise to a lot of complaints from members about, well, that's not fair in my circumstance. So thinking about some of those issues, and is there a solution to the divorce issue, or is there not? Is that just too hard and one person gets all the money and you hope that they may or may not be on speaking terms and deal with a few thousand dollars in some way? And terminal allocations I think is an interesting thing to think about, given that you are going to cut things off at 10 or 20 years because you don't know whether members have been there for a long time or not. Do you say, well, I know you were there on that date, and I know a lot of you are there on that date. I don't know whether you joined that day, the day before, or 10 years prior. Do you give them all an additional allocation to recognise the fact that, well, I don't know when you joined, I know that you had some period of membership at that time? Versus Peter's point that says, probably there's been some near-death experience from the fund during that whole time, and there was no surplus if you called a halt to it and tried to distribute the funds then. Just quickly, actuarial advice. Actuaries are involved in this, of course. And I found this, the Reserve Bank Health Fund split off from the Commonwealth Bank Health Fund in 1959. Maybe this was the first health insurance transaction with an actuary involved. But and there was just a basis on which it was done. It was about £200,000 that was divided at the time. But we've now got a more rich body of actuarial involvement in health insurance transactions. The actuaries have expressed opinions on the fairness of the allocation rules, reasonable benefit expectations of members going forward, the impact on future contribution rates and the security of benefits. And one of the major considerations has been the net impact of the additional costs of post-demutualisation, which come by way of tax and dividends, and probably in reduced surplus available, versus reliance on the competitive marketplace to stop funds putting up prices unnecessarily, and the fact that members always have the safety net of portability to go to other funds. So I suppose my provocative question, although we haven't probably got time for it here, is there actually any value left in a not-for-profit health insurer, given that it seems to have been a pretty easy case that most of the demutualisations have made to say that the additional costs of tax and dividend are far outweighed by the payment you're getting and the continuation of a competitive marketplace. And just continuing on, I suppose, things associated with the demutualisation activity, NIB rejected a takeover late last year. Australian Unity and GMHBA have considered and dismissed, for the moment anyway, demutualising. And I put Medibank Private in there as well because when we were at the last convention, we were perhaps facing Medibank Private also listing, but with the change in government, Labor policy is to retain Medibank in government ownership. And I don't know why I put that in there, Mark, but just to show you what's happened. We do have a listed health fund that, you know, you have now have a price of a health fund on a daily basis. It's probably fair to say the NIB share price has held up pretty well during, if you put any other listed company up there. But it seems to have stabilised around about 80 cents after having quite a wide range, trading range in its first 2 years.
So what's its cost per member to buy one?
Right.
Am I real market test?
Yeah, I suppose that's right. My concluding slide is a thank you to all those funds, actually, and all the people involved for providing the roadmap for those that are going to go down this path in future. There's a rich topic and an area for people to research, so it's really provided me with the opportunity to write a paper.
Has anyone got a short, burning question that they just really have to ask?
Yeah, I just want to ask Andrew that when he drops a penny on my head, can we make it a 1931?
Yes.
Please thank Andrew.